You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 264 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you once again from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Hello!
So,
the sighs are back. That's what I'll say. I found myself sighing right before you started. It's like the awkward pauses may be gone, but the sighs are back, baby.
Did the sighs ever go away?
I don't know if they come through on Zoom quite as well.
I think there was a moment where both of us sighed at the same time, possibly last week.
Oh, nice.
And that was solid. I don't know if it was quite captured by the Fabulous Pelton quotes.
Oh.
So I think only one of our sighs was recorded. Well, let's get right into it. We got a lot to talk about this week, and let's start with our beer of the week, which is the Vega IPA from Fremont Brewery, which you picked up at the Urban Beer Garden, correct?
Absolutely, I did. This is an Urban Beer Garden only release, so it's the only place that I could have picked it up.
Well, yes, by definition, but repeatedly we have been going and just getting beer from their like takeout area.
Mm-hmm.
But you actually went to the beer garden.
To the Urban Beer Garden, yes.
How was that?
It's
been remodeled.
It's really nice. I mean, the outdoor patio area is pretty phenomenal. There's quite a few tables. They're a little bit distance. It's a really nice place to hang out. So this was on the Sunday before Memorial Day and driving into Seattle and was going to get dinner and then just like, oh, I'll just pop into the beer garden like an idiot, right? And I'm like, I'm just going to pull up their website, see if there's any sort of like, you know, structure to get a table or if, to get their number to call ahead. And I look and they're like, you can check in through open table if there's no spots. And then I'm like, oh, I'll just throw my name on the waiting list. Whatever, I'll be there at 6 or whatever, just RSVP for 6 o'clock. And then it's like, there's no time that you choose. You're just on a long wait list. And guess what number I was on the wait list?
Well, I previously guessed. You've told me, but I guessed that you were number 50 in line based on your saying that there were so many people.
Then you still didn't guess low enough. Number 56 in line. The amount of people throughout Seattle who want to be drinking at Fremont Urban Beer Garden at any given time is all of them.
I mean, it's always high, but probably post-pandemic, even higher.
Oh, my God. Say. So I called around.
Not post-pandemic.
I was like, all right, number 56, I have no chance of getting into the Urban Beer Garden. So I was calling around all these other places. I called to Rooftop Brewery, which technically is in Queen Anne. It's like the easternmost point of Queen Anne, sort of by the old Sonic's offices, but not across the Ballard Bridge. So it's still technically Queen Anne.
Okay.
I guess, did I say easternmost point? I guess that would be the northernmost point of Queen Anne.
Yes.
Look at that. Look at friggin' knowing directions.
Wow. We're making progress here.
I called the Red Hook Brew Lab, and I'm like, how crazy is it? I'm just like, how many people are there right now? And they're like, yeah, there's tables open. So people do not want to be at any brewery. People want to be at the Fremont Urban Beer Garden.
Well, wait, do these places have outdoor seating, though?
Yes, they do.
Okay, well...
Rooftop Brewing is only outdoor seating, and the Brew Lab also has outdoor seating.
Is it on the rooftop?
Yeah. Oh. So, I don't know, I haven't ever been there, but... Gotcha. And I still didn't go, because as I was going to go get the food that I was going to eat that day, I got a text, and I was like, a miracle just happened. I got this text in perfect time, too, because you have to get there pretty fast. I was like in Capitol Hill, and then I just like immediately turned and drove to Fremont. It was like, we're going to... I mean, it's not that long of a drive on a Sunday. But immediately went there, had some phenomenal beers. Everything tasted great at Fremont Brewing and saw that they had a brewery-only release. And I said, should I get this? And you said, of course you should.
I mean, this has been a staple throughout the past year here for us when we've basically exclusively been doing local beer. And Fremont has been a big part of it. So the Vega IPA is part of their brewery-only release series. A two-row pale with Comet, Chinook, and Nelson Sauvin hops. I'm not really familiar with those hops particularly.
Now, can you tell me what makes it a two-row pale?
No, I have no idea. It's not that kind of beer podcast, as it turns out.
It just says India Pale Ale on the can. That's an IPA.
We're gonna have to consult with an actual beer podcast to figure out what that means because I am not qualified to speak on it whatsoever.
I'll ask Alex Kidd.
I am qualified to say it's delicious.
There we go.
So our toast this week Again, it's not an all UW softball, but it's an all UW toast. So we start, even though it's a sad note for UW softball at the end of the season, we're pouring one out for the end of the season. But first, a toast to Sis Bates for becoming UW's all-time hits leader with two hits Friday in the opening game of the Super Regionals against Oklahoma, passing Sarah Pickering for that honor. The Huskies lost that opener by a 4-2 final, with Taryn Atlee getting thrown out at home plate for the final out with the tying run at first base. Were you watching live at this point?
I wasn't, no.
Yeah, I missed this as well. I watched the start of the game.
I was going with the bros to the casino on Friday, and I had it up on my phone.
You are really living that post-vax life.
As we were getting in the car, and it was like, I was like, can I just be like, hey, bros, can we watch softball on my phone? But I feel like it would have just destroyed my battery. So I found out later. I do have to say, I think there's an adage, a baseball cliche, that you never want to make the last out at home or whatever.
I don't know. You don't want to make the first or third out at third base, I think, is the adage you're thinking of. But
there's complicated adages in baseball.
But in this case, it didn't make sense because that run didn't actually matter.
That was the thing, whereas like this was really not a good decision.
And it seemed like, you know, Parr's post-game comments were that she didn't send Taryn Atlee, but she didn't stop Taryn Atlee either. So it just kind of happened, and she wishes she could have done it over again, basically. So such is life. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, that proved to be the Huskies' best chance against this powerful Oklahoma team, which smashed them 9-1 in the second game to end the season short of the Women's College World Series for the first time since 2016. That you did watch. I didn't see any of this because I was going down to Portland, as we'll talk about later.
I mean, I didn't see, there were some grievances to be aired in game one. Like, look, the reality is Oklahoma is playing every single one of these games at home. They're not only playing, they're playing all of these.
I mean, most of the teams, the top eight seeds, all play.
But also, they're going to be playing all the games at home after that. And it's like,
in Oklahoma, they're not at their stadium.
There's literally no difference.
There was a lot of fans in that stadium in Oklahoma and not a lot of masks.
Oh, yeah. But I'm sure the heavy vaxxing, though, among the Oklahomans.
They were all in the Husky dugout, or all the masks.
It's like when Luca's team travels to Deep Maple Valley or whatever.
Yes.
That was UW traveling to Oklahoma. That was the equivalent. But there were apparently some grievances to be aired in game one because of where the strike zone was drawn, correct?
Specifically, the left-hand batter's box appeared to be substantially too close to home plate.
In game two in the series, there were balls that looked like strikes to me and everybody else who was watching, except for the umpire of this game that Gabby Plain was throwing. I think in the second inning when she got roughed up a little bit, didn't give up a ton of runs, but like these are balls that were like right on the bottom half of the strike zone, which is where Gabby Plain lives.
Yes.
And so if you don't give Gabby Plain the bottom half of the strike zone, she cannot pitch. So it makes sense to me that they ended up getting roughed up after that. It's like if you're literally taking the one pitch that your star pitcher can throw and you're not going to call that a strike, there's nothing else that can be done.
I saw on UWDogPan.com that Zion Tupuola-Fatui tweeted, "I couldn't tell you where the strike zone is right now."
See, so, if ZTF can't tell you where the strike zone is, who can? noted strike zone understander, softball ZTF. But it was like these.
I mean, the Huskies work defensively on the strike zone in terms of where to hit. It's a little different concept, but he's familiar with strike zones.
The ball, but you understand what I'm saying? Where it's like this got out of control because Gabby Plain couldn't do what Gabby Plain does. Right? That would be like taking Dame Lillard and being like, you can't shoot threes. Like all of a sudden he's a lot easier to defend, right? And if you're Gabby Plain, you're like, you're not going to get a strike on the bottom half of the strike zone, then everything is going to be over the plate. That's it.
And she did do an excellent job on Friday holding that Oklahoma offense, which one thing I didn't realize in my prep until they mentioned it on the broadcast on Friday is that they were averaging the most runs, not just this season, which we mentioned, they were like four runs ahead of anyone else in the country. The most runs in Division I college softball history.
Are they potentially the greatest softball team of all time?
That line was mentioned at one point during the broadcast. So I think it's a legitimate consideration, assuming that they finish this off in the Women's College World Series. They'll face.
I'm sure it was. I'm sure the entire reason they're the greatest softball team ever is because they have a notebook in the dugout where they record what happens.
See, like, I'd missed this storyline
so
entirely.
Stupid. It's like, okay, dude, this is not that. I'm like, they're like such a smart team. You know, they've got a notebook in the dugout. It's like, oh, great.
Which I guess they did mention this on Friday. This is they've where they're managed, recording.
No, they
notes
definitely.
Only
I
at
heard
bats.
It on Friday and multiple times on Saturday. They were like, they came up with the concept of taking notes on their at bat. Oh my God. That's why they're the best team ever. It doesn't have anything to do with the fact that they host the World Series in their hometown. Therefore, they could become the best team and also recruit the best players.
Not their hometown. Yes, I think they said that their two-star freshmen were the top 1 and 2 recruits in the country this year.
It's just like,
yeah, okay, I do think that probably has more to do with it.
The entire softball system is rigged in favor of Oklahoma.
Well, same
with basketball and Gonzaga.
I've always said that. So they will face two Pac-12 teams potentially in the Women's College World Series as Arizona went on the road and won at Arkansas, joining UCLA, which was the lone Pac-12 team to host a Super Regional. Pac-12, two teams in the Women's College World Series tied with the Big 12 and SEC for the most among the 8-team field. They're both on the same side of the bracket, opposite Oklahoma, along with number 3 seed Alabama and number 10 seed Florida State.
We're UCLA fans now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay. Go Rachel Garcia and company. Maya Brady, etc. This is the final. We're pouring one out for the UW careers of some great players.
Okay, so we're still talking softball for a second.
Yeah.
I do have questions.
Yeah, we're pouring some out for Bates, who played this year as a grad student.
Okay, definitely will not be back.
I don't think there's a mechanism. Even though this wasn't a year of eligibility for anyone, I still think the extra year of eligibility that they were granted last year still only applied to this year, basically, for the spring sports that didn't have the opportunity to play their championships because of the start of the pandemic. So that's Bates, Taryn Atley, Morgan Flores, and Kaya Gibson, all of whom reached 3 Women's College World
Series.
That's
a lot of talent.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, some key players in the roster. Other seniors who were honored at Senior Day a couple weeks ago at UW Softball Stadium were 4th-year seniors Emma Helm, Noelle He, Pat Moore, and Levy Sheely. But good news, Gabby Plain has indicated she'll be back for her 5th year of eligibility next year. So that's
huge.
Exciting. Yeah.
But still losing a lot of talent. So I was under the impression that Gabby Plain is coming back, but basically all of the offense is gone.
I mean, not all of the offense, but I mean, Sis Bates' value both offensively and defensively.
Yes.
Pam Ward has been very high on the concept of creating a Defensive Player of the Year award in softball to honor Sis Bates. She's just been deemed the unofficial winner by ESPN's Pam Ward.
Why do they not have a Defensive Player of the Year award?
I don't know. It's a good question, but apparently they don't in college softball. I mean, you're still bringing back some solid offensive players. You know, it's not the entire offense, but it's two of your top 3 hitters, basically, in Flores and Bates. So. Yeah, there's definitely going to be some work to be done, some development. All right, sticking with UW theme, a toast to UW men's crew, which won their 19th national championship. As always, we always remember this time of year. Anytime softball loses, we're a men's crew school, or just a crew school in general, generally. 19th national championship at Sunday's Intercollegiate Rowing Association Championship Regatta, sweeping all 4 grand finals, the 8th title since 2007 for UW. Not quite as good a result for the defending champion women's crew, which finished tied for 1st place in team points, but finished 3rd due to the tiebreaker, which was the Varsity 8, I believe, where they finished 3rd.
Does UW host the regatta?
They do not host the regatta.
Okay, so it seemed likely to me.
I don't know if it rotates. Maybe they do at some point, but they didn't this year.
Okay.
They do host the Windermere Cup. Mm-hmm. That they host. Okay, with toasts in the books, we're going to start by talking about the Seahawks because it's a semi-emergency pod. Some big news. Well, not big news, but a notable report over the weekend from my ESPN colleague Diana Rossini, who reported on Sunday that the Seahawks have had discussions about trading for Julio Jones and that Russell Wilson has spoken to Jones about playing together.
Interesting. So I didn't know where this came from. I all of a sudden, I wasn't paying attention to Twitter for like 4 hours. And then all of a sudden, everybody was talking about Julio Jones and the Seahawks. And it's like, are we just doing this because this is a Seahawks thing to do?
I mean, it is a Seahawks thing to do.
Oh, I mean, that's part of why, like, you see these reports and you're like, okay, yeah, that seems reasonable, right? Like, if there's going to be a splash trade or if a high-leverage player is disgruntled, you know the Seahawks are going to be in the mix.
Sorry, you know he's going to the NFC West.
Oh, absolutely.
Know.
Yes.
So the backstory here, the context, last Monday, Jones was talking to FS1's Shannon Sharp on the Undisputed program and said, asked about Atlanta, said, "I'm out of there." Adam Schefter has reported that he requested a trade in March from the team. Wow. And so this is just kind of an escalation of the fact that that hasn't taken place yet. Now, part of the reason that hasn't happened, we'll get to, is timing with his contract. Russini also reported last week that the Falcons have an offer of a first-round pick in 2022 on the table. So that does complicate issues for the Seahawks, who don't have their first-round pick next year from the Jamal Adams trade.
Because their previous high-leverage trade.
Having already done that. I mean, the Rams have also been linked to Julio Jones, and they also don't have their first-round pick in 22. So I don't know how that's going to work. But
Eerily similar. At least the Lakers won a championship, but it feels eerily similar to like the Lakers Clippers going back and forth, or NBA teams being like, we need more, right? And for the Clippers in particular, where it's like, it's not even known if they'll get out of the first round, right? Like, but they're like, we're all in right now.
Well, yeah. It's much more possible to go all in and lose badly in the first round in the NFL, as it turns out. So it's unclear whether, you know, the Seahawks really have a legitimate chance to beat that offer if that first round pick is actually on the table. And, you know, depending on whether it's conditional or there's other picks, you know, you're asking for a fourth or a third
they
back
can
from Atlanta.
Always beat the offer. That's the thing.
You can beat the offer, but are they going to, you know, are they reasonably going to be motivated to win if there's actually a bidding war? Or is this a case of we're having these conversations in case Julio Jones comes relatively cheap? Because there was a lot of talk last week in particular about Mohamed Sanu got traded by the Falcons a couple of years ago to the Patriots midseason for a second round pick. Mm-hmm. Are they going to get the same thing for Julio Jones that they got for Mohamed Sanu?
Pretty wild. I mean, that was swindling.
It was. It was an all-time great trade. Fleecing of the New England Patriots, who, by the way, are a team of very much or a Julio Jones possibility. So let's talk about Julio Jones's contract, as I mentioned a moment ago, and how that affects things. He's got a $15.3 million guaranteed salary for 2021 and $11.5 million salaries for 2022 and 2023, of which just $2 million is guaranteed. And a huge amount of prorated signing bonus still left that, if they had traded him by today as we record this on May 31st, would have all accelerated to their cap in 2021. As of Tuesday, June 1st, that changes, where only this year's cap hit, or this year's prorated signing bonus, goes on your cap this year. The rest would go on your cap in 2022, which is what makes it feasible for the Falcons to now make this trade.
Okay. So he's much more likely to be traded June 1st on.
Right. I mean, it could have been something like, you know, the Stafford trade was agreed to in, what, early February or something like that, right before the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
But they didn't actually complete it until the start of the new league year, until like March. So it could have been something like that, where they agreed to it ahead of time and just waited to consummate it until now. But you would assume that kind of accelerates the timetable for actually making a decision for the Falcons. So wherever he ends up, I would say it's very likely that that guaranteed 2021 salary gets converted to a new signing bonus that would just allow that team to spread the cap hit out over the remaining three seasons on the contract, or maybe even add a year, similar to what the Seahawks did with a lot of their players this year to, you know, kind of push that cap hit into the future. And they would obviously need to do that if that happens, because according to Over the Cap, they have just $7.25 million in cap space at this point.
Tell us about Julio Jones as a player right now. The cap hit's not terrible. It's for a player who is, at least has previously been at an extraordinarily high caliber of wide receiver, this is not a brutal hit.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that makes this a reasonable trade and a good value is this is different than a Jamal Adams situation, where you're going to trade for the player and then they haven't done it yet, but presumably you're going to hand them a huge new contract not long afterwards. Julio Jones is already under contract for 3 years, and you don't have to, the signing bonus
is
paid by the Falcons.
He's also significantly older than Jamal Adams.
I mean, I'm not saying, well, I mean, third Pelton brother Ben Baldwin ran a poll about, given contract, age, everything, who would you rather have, Julio Jones or Jamal Adams? And it ended up pretty close to 50-50.
The answer is also who's currently on the team.
I mean, I voted for Julio.
We already have one of those players. So like, when you're voting for it, it's like, we've seen what the Seahawks look like with Jamal Adams. So what they would look like with Julio Jones is so much more exciting.
I guess that's true. But also, we saw what they looked like with Jamal Adams, and it wasn't transformative defensively. So,
but also, I mean, we could talk about positional value. Let's come back to that in a second. There's a reason that the answer is given all of these things, you would choose Julio Jones if that were your answer, which is offense is just more valuable than defense.
And I think he's proven that his ability can translate into team success much more clearly than Jamal Adams can. So Jones turned 32 in February. He finished 16th in DR last season, a bit behind Tyler Lockett, who was 14th, but that was in just 9 games. So on a per-target basis, he ranked 2nd in DVOA last year. His 11.3 yards per target ranked 3rd among qualifying receivers, a stat in which DK Metcalf ranked 8th. So this is still someone who's playing at a high level. There's going to be some people out there who are going to be like, well, Julio Jones doesn't score very many touchdowns, so he's not very good. And those people, A, need to stop playing so much fantasy football, and B, just should not be allowed to talk about football on the internet.
Wow. Okay.
Julio Jones is awesome. If the Seahawks somehow were to add him to DK Metcalf and Tyler Lockett, that would probably be the greatest receiver trio of all time, right? Like, that would have to be, wouldn't it?
The greatest receiver trio of all time.
I mean, to have, you know, probably 3 at minimum top 15 receivers? Like, that's even being reasonably pessimistic about Tyler Lockett, I think, at this point?
It's an interesting question. I mean, my understanding was basically that Julio Jones hadn't fallen off at all, right? Like, even though he is 32, just from an outside perspective, not thinking that much about Julio Jones, aside from the touchdowns, which are mostly irrelevant, he's been a monster receiver every year of his entire career.
Yep.
Missed some time this year. I feel like he's somebody who's been a little bit banged up, but you look at it, and he hasn't missed that many games. You know, last season was the first time that he missed any sort of significant chunk of games since his third season. Julio Jones is in the conversation for best receiver in the league. Maybe not in this exact moment, but when you look at the entire body of work, he's one of, if not the best receiver in the game in a lot of ways. Now, at the same time, you look at what a team like, let's say that DeAndre Hopkins, Julio Jones, right?
Right. That was the comparison I was about to draw.
And they're on very similar platforms. Right?
What do you mean platforms?
Or they're similarly credentialed as wide receivers. And you look at what the Cardinals had to trade for DeAndre Hopkins.
Well, that was a once in a time thing. It turns out that Bill O'Brien is not running the Atlanta Falcons.
You don't get the like Texan sneak. I'm just kidding.
I mean, look, we got in on the Texan sneak ourselves with Dwayne Brown, and Clowney.
Clowney, we twiddled him more for Clowney. Dwayne Brown we paid real value for.
Yes, but I would say the Dwayne Brown trade is one I would do again in a heartbeat. Especially if the original, you remember the original, Bill O'Brien wasn't actually running the team at this point, in fairness. Well, actually, and myself. But remember, the original version that included Jeremy Lane was much more favorable for the Seahawks before he failed his physical.
Oh, yeah.
So. But,
did,
yeah.
What did Diggs get traded for? A second-round pick?
No, Diggs got traded for the pick that became Jefferson.
Which was a second-round pick, wasn't it?
No, that was a first-round.
It was a first?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Jefferson was taken in the first round.
And Stephon Diggs is obviously
was a win-win.
Significantly younger than Julio is.
Yeah, and that's a factor in this. That's why he's not going to go for that kind of huge draft pick compensation. But, I mean, if the Seahawks were sitting here and they had all their draft picks, I would be pretty gung-ho in favor of this, even though I don't love trading future draft picks. The fact that they're already out a first-round pick makes it a little harder to justify, I would say.
I guess a couple of questions to bring up with the potential of Julio Jones, which is, if the Seahawks are going all in on wide receivers, right? They're having 3 of the best wide receivers in the league. The idea that Pete Carroll would come in and fix the offense and skew them away from passing the ball, like, he kind of just can't do that, right? Like, if you're going to have these 3 wide receivers, you have to pass the damn ball.
This is like Third Pelton brother Ben Baldwin's tweet about, you know, someone tweeted, what's stopping this offense if they have Julio Jones and
the rule
and
of 53.
But the thing is,
let's say that they have these 3 receivers, you might still get to the rule of 53. I bet some of those Patriots teams with Randy Moss did also, because you score so many points that you're able to run the ball out at the end of the game. Let Chris Carson run the ball in the second half. But like, in this new offense that we're anticipating to see with these 3 receivers, with some motion involved in the offense, I mean,
it'd be interesting to put Tyler Lockett in the slot pretty much full time, which is something.
I mean, any of them in the slot.
Yes, you're going to create a lot of mismatches no matter what you're doing. I mean, you have 2 of the most physically unguardable the wide receivers in NFL history in Julio Jones and DK Metcalf, and they'd be on the same team. That would be wild to watch.
They already were close to being a historically good offense in the first 8 weeks of last season also, and that was without Julio Jones.
And the thing that Ben brought up, like, we're just going to quote his tweets throughout this podcast, and we probably should just bring him on, it would be easier, is but it's way past his bedtime. It's closer to when he wakes up than it is to when he went to bed. Tyler Lockett has a history of getting banged up over the course of the season, and you know, a big three in terms of wide receivers is different than a big three in basketball because you don't rest players in quite the same way, but it's similar, I think, to the theory of putting together like the Nets big three. It's just, even if, you know, James Harden has a hamstring injury or if Kevin Durant is injured, you still have the other two guys. And that was what was the big issue last year, is when Tyler Lockett was a mere mortal.
The last two seasons,
then the Seahawks offense was very different. So in other words, let's trade for Julio Jones.
I mean, fuck it, right? Like, whatever. They already have proven that they're not going to care about draft capital at this point. If what you're going to do is go all in on these handful of seasons, I mean, the reality is Russell Wilson is not a young quarterback right now.
I gotta say, if you want to make Russell Wilson happy after the whole kerfuffle earlier in the offseason, getting that man Julio Jones, that's a big upgrade on Antonio Brown.
Well, and also, I think that it could go a long way in also making sure that he had a little bit more time to get the ball off as well.
It just creates a lot of good problems.
Having those receiving options, again, you know, with the new offense that we're anticipating to see, all of these things could lead to a much happier Russell Wilson. But he's 32, 33 years old.
Russell?
Yeah.
I don't know off the top of my head. But yes, a similar timetable to Julio Jones. I've got it.
Not a similar timetable because he's a quarterback and not a receiver. Right. But like the...
He is 32.
It's time to win now again. If you're going to do it, you might as well fucking do it, right?
It's time to win now again. That's not win forever. That definitely is not win forever.
They had a window when they had to go all in the first period when they had the defense that they knew was going to go away at some point, and it did. And now they have another window, right? Like, Russell Wilson probably will play till he's 40 plus, but is he going to be as effective? This is every single year. This is sad to say, actually. Every single year that Russell Wilson plays will probably be the best season that we see from Russell Wilson ever again. He has reached his apex as far as ability goes, most likely.
Every time you see me, it is the worst day of my life. No, I mean, things aren't that predictable. So there's a chance that, you know, he could oscillate back and forth, as we've seen during his ostensible prime over the last few years here. But yes, in terms of the likelihood, he is not likely to get better at any point going forward.
The way that you make Russell Wilson better is by giving him Julio Jones.
Now, all this said, chances of the Seahawks trading for Julio Jones?
I feel like they're kind of high.
I'm ballparking them at 5%. Because
5%? I mean, have you met the Seahawks?
But have you met NFL teams trading superstars? One thing they don't love to do is trade them within the same conference. They will find any excuse to trade him to the Titans, probably, or the Patriots, to the AFC. Like, it just never happens. Like, who was the... Like, we just mentioned those two guys, Stephon Diggs and DeAndre Hopkins. Guess where they got traded? To the other conference. I guess the Texans did trade when they traded for Tunsil, I guess. That was within conference.
This offensive lineman that you're bringing up?
The Dolphins
were willing to let the Texans pay them handsomely for Laremy Tunsil in conference.
I'm just looking forward to the team that says, you know what, we don't think this guy is that good. We're excited to trade him within conference. Hell, let's go within division so we can face him twice a year. I don't think Julio Jones will be that
poor. How much do you think Julio Jones's wishes play into this?
I think that, you know, if there's a list of teams that might be accommodated, I don't think they're going to train him to a specific destination.
But Russell Wilson talking to Julio Jones, does that mean anything?
It means something. It doesn't mean nothing. But again, I don't think it affects... The Falcons aren't going to take a worse offer because of the fact that Julio Jones wants to play with Russell Wilson. So my ballpark is like 5%.
You said that 5%. Yeah. I just don't. I could see the Seahawks being willing to go above and beyond to make this deal. They've done it over and over and over again. They've overpaid for players. You know what I mean? They've consistently overpaid for players. And what is to make you think that they're not going to overpay for Julio Jones?
The fact that they've done it in the past makes it incrementally less likely that they will do it in the future. Like, they haven't done it when they were already out first-round picks. The Rams have done that. Like, they've stacked first-round picks, the Cooks trade followed by the Jalen Ramsey trade. But the Seahawks haven't necessarily done that. They've waited a few years between these big swing trades where they've given up a first-round pick.
Has there been a time that any of these big swing trades have paid off, so to say?
For the Seahawks?
Right? Like, I mean, they won the Super Bowl post-Percy Harvin, but, like, they probably would have won the Super Bowl without Percy Harvin.
I mean, without that kickoff return to start the second half. It would, if Golden Tate hadn't motivated by getting in a fight with Percy Harvin the day before the Super Bowl, who could say butterfly effect? Yes, I mean,
but they have not stopped. That's what I'm saying to you. They traded for Percy Harvin, and then they came right back and traded for Jimmy Graham, and then they came right back and traded for Jamal Adams.
Also, think how valuable these draft picks are going to be now that you can again scout players, presumably, in the next few years here.
There is a higher percentage chance than 5%. I mean, if they don't trade for him, we won't have known. You know what I mean? Like, it's almost like a fool's errand to do percentage chances of...
Well, it's a Schrodinger's cat situation. Yes. They've either traded for Julio Jones or not. We just don't know yet.
The answer is it's 100% or 0% to whether they will trade for Julio Jones. But like...
But that's the same thing as anything. The chances of the Seahawks winning, we don't know what they actually were. We still give an estimate of it, and then they either win or they don't. But, I mean, that's how it works.
It's never... So much easier to imagine how a football game could play out, say, 1,000 times or 100 times than it is to how a trade negotiation that we don't know anything about. See, the thing about a football game,
it's not like Nate Silver gets to see 1,000 versions of the election. He only gets the election that actually happens.
But you see everything that goes into it. A football trade, all the information you have is an ESPN report that somebody has, and then what the trade was until there's a book about it 10 fucking years later.
Oh, you also have Danny Ainge saying how close they got to making the trade.
So close.
Agonizingly close.
Who was that they were agonizingly close?
Who wasn't it? Jimmy Butler? Paul George? Paul George,
they really thought they were getting Paul George. So. There's many of these trades that they probably got to pull it on.
The Pacers traded him to the other conference.
Wow.
Really brought that home at the end there.
That was really good. Anyway, trading for Julio Jones would be very exciting. And ultimately, the thing about trading draft picks is it means that the draft is not that exciting. And potentially your future is terrible. But Julio Jones for 16 weeks, this is the same thing with Jamal Adams. Jamal Adams for 16 weeks is more fun than not Jamal Adams for 16 weeks.
I suppose.
Look,
we had a boring draft,
right? Because of Jamal Adams, we had a boring draft. But also, Jamal Adams for 16 different times throughout the year is much more exciting than one draft. Same with Julio Jones.
I think it's much more true in the whole case of Julio Jones.
I said don't interrupt us, but do you have thoughts on Julio Jones and the Seahawks, Luca? You're terribly far from the microphone. Nobody can hear you.
We are a team that...
Still, I don't know if you know how microphones work. You need to talk into them.
We still are sort of a team that is a team that likes to do, like, big trades. So I wouldn't be too shocked if we traded for Julio, but I really don't think it would happen.
You think about a 5% chance?
Maybe that.
Okay. Good to know. Thanks, Luke.
Go to bed. 5% chance.
So the other thing with this...
Now that we're recording live, it's going to be weekly that I tell Luca to go to bed. For disagreeing with me.
Welcome to Parents Corner. Pete Carroll also said last week at the voluntary OTAs that the door is open to KJ Wright returning, but nothing imminent, and it did not make it sound super likely, I gotta say.
Is KJ Wright gonna be out of the league after having a monster season?
Well, the problem is that KJ Wright is too old because he is, what, also 32, right? God. He hasn't even turned 32 yet. He'll turn 32 in July.
We're trading the first round picks for 32-year-olds. We've got 32-year-olds who are anchoring our franchise for 10 years. KJ Wright can't be on the team because he's not even 32.
Not that, you know, aging curves aren't different by position, but this league is real dumb sometimes. Oh, should we talk about food?
Oh, God.
So our search for Seattle's best fried chicken took us last week not to someplace in Seattle.
Oh, hello.
But to Tacoma. You know where we went. You ate this food.
I'm just dramatic responding
to okay.
you.
Okay. Which to Southern Kitchen, which was recommended to us by the listener Jimmer, who said he ate there many times after playing poker all night at Muggle Shoot or Diamond Lil's in, his words, beautiful downtown Renton. So Southern Kitchen opened in 1981 in Tacoma's Hilltop neighborhood, but really took on its current form in 1994 when Gloria Martin bought the restaurant and began serving the soul food that she learned from her father, an army chef. This has been a notable restaurant. It was featured on Dine-In's Drive... I got this wrong. Wait, what's the name of the show? Dining something and dives.
You got all these wrong.
Oh, no.
Diners, drive-ins, and dives.
That's it. Yes. Okay. Yeah.
You wrote dining's, drivers, and dives.
Look, I can't justify what I wrote here. In 2009, and also was setting for Kevin Hart's Heart of the City Seattle episode, which I did not know was a show that existed. I just learned that in 2017. So,
you know, love.
We'll talk about this trip in a bit, but on my way back from Portland on Saturday, swung by Southern Kitchen, and it was a great, great setting. A lot of people there eating, watching. They had the playoffs on in the back corner, so I was able to catch that as I was waiting for our takeout, and picked up. We did a half fried chicken, which was, I think, 5 pieces of fried chicken, which comes with 2 sides. We did mashed potatoes and gravy and mac and cheese are 2 sides. Also a cornbread pancake, which is fascinating. Mm-hmm. Never had anything like that. And then also added on, we had to do it, the candied yams.
Oh, of course.
Which were a real star of the show, as they always are, I would have to say. So I brought this back and we ate it together. What did you think here?
So, you know, I vowed to only eat this chicken fresh.
Yeah.
This was the only way for this to happen, really. Not the only way. I could go to Tacoma. It's not that far. But
we're not in Tacoma on a regular basis.
And you were driving through Tacoma. So it made sense for you to pick it up and eat it not quite as fresh. So I guess I will preface it by saying that I think there's a difference between extraordinarily fresh chicken and chickens that's been sitting for 20 minutes. This never touched any part of your car, though.
Yes, that is absolutely the case.
You know, I thought the chicken was super well done, right? The chicken itself, I tried dipping it in the gravy, similar to what we saw at Musong the previous week, where I was like, if there's freaking gravy around, I'm going to be dipping the chicken in the
gravy.
Yeah. And the chicken was at an extraordinarily high level, but I don't know if it's a real competitor for Seattle's best chicken.
I thought the spicing in particular was pretty strong here, but... Yeah, I would agree with that. I think it's just a notch below. And I'm not even sure that fried chicken is probably their best, you know, main course. We didn't try the catfish.
That's the main thing to me is I feel like the way that it's fried is it almost you can taste that like they're a catfish place or they're frying other foods besides chicken. It's a different type of fry.
It's sometimes we're almost limited by our search for Seattle's best fried chicken to not trying some of the other things on the menu as far as the main dishes, yes. And that is almost a limitation.
But also, candied yams.
Undefeated. Never lost.
Mac and cheese. Maybe the best mac and cheese that we've had at a fried chicken place.
Interesting.
I thought the mac and cheese was awesome. Just the whole package. I mean, I liked it all, right? The whole thing. When you're there and you're like, I can have candied yams, I can have mashed potatoes, I can have fried chicken. I can have a cornbread pancake. There's nothing not to like about the entire situation. And it's just like, it was one of those things similar to the oyster bar that we went to, where it's like, I like the entire package, but if we're just isolating the fried chicken, it's not quite as good as some of the other competitors.
Exactly. I think I feel exactly the same way. So I scored the Southern Kitchen in 87.
That seems good.
Okay.
Great. 87. Also, so Jimmer was playing poker all night at Diamond Lil's in Renton and then drove to Tacoma.
What? So I'm pretty sure, like, you know, the whole Jimmer biography is a fascinating thing.
Jimmer on to talk about his experience in Seattle.
But I think he, if I recall correctly, that he may have gone to Evergreen State College. So it would have been potentially on his drive back at some point.
He was playing poker all night?
Well, if he was playing, going from Renton to Tacoma, the way back from there to Olympia.
If you went to the Evergreen State College and drove to Diamond Lils in Renton to play poker,
look,
I'm impressed.
I mean, I'm not sure what the time frame was here exactly, but I don't think the options were as plentiful as they are now.
And then stopped off in the middle to go and get Southern Kitchen fried chicken?
Yeah. So.
Wow. Maybe when our middle child goes to the Evergreen State College.
He's going to have a great time there. There's going to be a lot of hacky sack involved, I feel like.
I don't know if people hacky the sack as much as they used to. That's really funny. So,
hello, fellow kids. Oh, that reference is dated now. That's the problem.
Wow. I would love to just have, I don't know if this is podcast material, just Jimmer's Pacific Northwest.
I mean,
not Jimmer's Seattle area.
We had him on the Friday mailbag a couple times, so. It's definitely a possibility.
The Pelton Cast Friday mailbag?
No, the True Hoop Friday mailbag.
You're saying that like we, as if I was on the True Hoop podcast.
But that was the royal we. I was part of it, so it was we.
You're now we?
I think so, yeah. Hmm. You know, we at ESPN like to... I don't have anything there. You mentioned
I never
earlier.
Once talk about when we were booking sold out shows for the True podcast. That's just me. I don't remember you doing anything.
You mentioned earlier that you got food before
they
going.
Let you on stage.
Oh,
Have you ever been on? I don't think you were on stage for a single show that I booked. Were you?
I think that yes, I stopped it. The Vegas show. You booked the Vegas show.
Oh,
I went on stage.
Yeah,
for
you were on stage for the Vegas show.
Man and I were up there.
I went out of my way to try to not get you on there, but...
Well, you were foiled in that, as it turned out.
I settled the score later on. When we booked the Vegas show.
So you mentioned, let's book a Seattle show. Let's figure that out.
For the podcast?
Yeah. Then we will let both of you on the stage, I guess.
Need to find a new agent.
You mentioned that when you went to the Urban Beer Garden, you had gotten dinner previously. Do you want to talk about that?
Sure.
You act like I'm just bringing this up out of nowhere as if this isn't something we talked about
previously. I didn't tell you that it was podcast material necessarily.
It's on the notes. I thought you saw it.
Just because you put it on the notes doesn't mean that I have to talk about it. No, so okay. Went to a location called Cornelli's in Capitol Hill.
Is it Cornelli's or Cornelli's?
It could be either. I don't know.
I could not find anything on the internet to determine this specifically.
So it's in the little block, sort of like East Capitol Hill, northeast Capitol Hill, one would say. Similar, there's like a Top Pot kind of hidden over there. There's a bar that I've been to a few times. You know what I'm talking about? Do you know where that Top Pot is?
I do not know where
it's
that
like
Top Pot
is. It's like
there's
a neighborhood of all these apartments and condos, and then boom, there's a Top Pot right
But
there.
I have a general idea from northeast Capitol Hill of where it is, assuming that your geography is correct here.
It is in the scenario.
Okay,
so close to the freeway. So it was just googling around places to eat in this area. I was staying in that area and this place kept popping up.
Which freeway? Because I-5 is a west Capitol Hill.
It might be west. God damn it.
This is all-time podcast geography. I love this.
I was on a roll geography-wise.
You did nail that Capitol Queen Anne reference the second time.
Still north.
Okay, the food, though.
Not terribly far from...
What happened?
East Capitol Hill.
I think that's probably Northwest Capitol Hill. I'm going to go with him.
Are you looking where the Top Pot is? Or the Cornelly's?
I am looking where Cornelly's. It's just Cornelly. It's not apostrophe.
Well, you put the apostrophe on here, so that's why I was reading it that way.
All right, that's my mistake.
Okay, so anyway, Dine-ins, Drivers, and Dives. The most important reason to talk about this, though, was that they advertised a sea salt chocolate chip cookie.
Yes.
And I don't agree
that that's the most important reason to talk about it, because I thought the most important reason was the Sunday square slices.
Oh, I didn't get it.
You didn't even get that? You went on a Sunday.
I got a whole pizza. It was phenomenal. The pizza was great. Ate it at Fremont Brewing. There's not anything more to it than that. Okay. Just a really, really good pizza. But they also called the pepperoni cups Roni cups. And I was like, not right. I'm not prepared for that yet.
Fair.
But
too soon.
They had a cookie that looked phenomenal. And I was like, you refuse to do a search for Seattle's best cookie.
I do. I hate the idea of searching for Seattle's
best cookie. But I'm hyper vigilant in trying to find Seattle's best cookie.
Maybe next spring.
And next spring?
I'm going to be over here
unofficially searching for Seattle's best cookie while you're just doing what? Frittering away in goddamn Portland?
I don't know if I was frittering. There were no fritters involved.
God. Anyway, so it's a phenomenal looking cookie. Sea salt, giant. It's called like a chocolate chunk cookie. And of course, so I got a pizza, a pasta, and a cookie.
And what type of pasta?
I don't know. There was maybe a pork belly in it.
Northeast pasta.
It was like a white sauce spaghetti with pork belly in it.
Okay.
It was phenomenal. But I'm trying to talk about the cookie. And the cookie, when I had it, it was still, like, the chocolate chips were still melted on the inside. It'd been a while. Like, it'd been an hour plus from the time that I picked it up to when I ate it. The chocolate chips were still melted on the inside. Phenomenal. Still not a competitor.
Wow.
The treat cookies, I'm ruined on cookies.
Have you seen what the theme is for treat cookies in this month?
Oh, God, what is it?
90s themed cookies. There's a Pop-Tart style cookie. I don't know what's going on there, but just I'm excited.
Shut up and take my money.
Exactly.
But it was an excellent cookie. It just wasn't on the level of treat cookies.
Which also, they don't specialize in cookies. They specialize in pizza.
Yeah, the pizza, the whole thing. Look, the pizzas that they make at treat cookies are terrible, I assume.
Pizza cookie. I don't know if you can pull that off. So I wanted to talk about what I had on my trip to Portland on Saturday. It was my second time going down to Portland since the pandemic started and second Blazers game. And last time I went to an old favorite in Screen Door. This time I wanted to go to a new place that I was very excited about, which is Toki. And so Peter Cho, the chef, opened Han Oak several years ago. I've been there one time. It's critically acclaimed. A great restaurant in Portland, but it's kind of a, you know, it's a fancier sit-down type restaurant, even though there's kind of a communal atmosphere. And during this pandemic period, he opened more of a casual restaurant downtown.
I don't know
why the term
critically acclaimed about a restaurant sounds so ridiculous to me. I mean, the Jenny Vall of restaurants. You don't even know what I'm talking about.
I have my own reference here.
What is your own reference?
What was the Cirque du Soleil show that had all the billboards?
What? That's critically acclaimed.
Someone said that. Who was it? Who said it was the greatest show I ever
saw? It's on the billboard.
Yeah, that's a claim.
Oh my God.
That's a claim.
Okay.
So it opened up a more casual restaurant, and the star of the show there. I got some donuts, which were good, but the star of the show there is their chicken sandwiches. Mm-hmm. And so I've been very excited to try this since I first found out about it, you know, 3 or 4 months ago, and finally got the opportunity to do it before game four of the Blazers Nuggets series. And let me tell you, this chicken sandwich, it more than lived up to the hype.
Hello.
Let me see if I can find it here to... talk about the details of it. This is interesting. I didn't realize this. It looks like they only serve it at their brunch on the weekends. But the Korean fried chicken sando, double fried boneless chicken thigh in sweet garlic soy glaze or chili oil, dipped and dusted with pickled daikon, cabbage, scallion, spicy mayo on a toasted Martin sesame seed potato bun. So you saw the photo that I posted online. The thing that stands out is, first off, the size of the chicken thigh kind of poking out of the bun, which was great, made it very visually appealing. But there's also what stood out is the spicy mayo. It's kind of like a sriracha type mayo.
Okay.
And that was extremely flavorful. And yet it wasn't even needed because the I went with the sweet garlic soy glaze version of this. I'm curious to try the chili oil version at some point in the future, but it's going to be hard to top this. Like, it didn't even need it because of the fact that the chicken itself with the sweet garlic soy glaze was so flavorful in and of itself. And then you added on the spicy mayo, and it was like two of the greatest flavors I ever tasted. I mean, this was an incredible chicken sandwich.
Wow.
So I don't know if I'm ready to put it ahead of Mono after having it one time.
Oh my God.
But I would put it ahead of any other chicken sandwich I've ever had in Seattle.
Wow.
And I guess any other chicken sandwich. I don't know if I've had any noted chicken sandwiches elsewhere at this point yet.
No. So, it's really fascinating to hear you say this. So you've said that you think that the best chicken that you've ever had is at the Screen Door in Portland. Best fried chicken would be number one chicken.
Correct.
And now you're considering whether the best chicken sandwich you've ever had is at Toki in Portland. And many experts, critics are asking the question, does ESPN's Kevin Pelton hate the city of Seattle?
I mean, again, I'm not ready to put it out of
Mono. The A's are going to be playing the Mariners for the next handful of days. I know that there's been talk about them moving to Portland. Is it hard for you to cheer for the Mariners in that time period?
First off, it's hard for me to cheer for the Mariners at any time period.
When you go to the Blazers games, are you cheering for the Blazers? Your podcast, the Fabulous Pelton Cast, I've heard that you even talk pro Blazers on that podcast. Well, couldn't Blazers. Be me. Or couldn't Blazers. Be me. People are even saying that your brother has said many times that he should be the host of Blazers Outsiders on the postgame show.
Too many times.
Yeah.
I'm just telling you, I call him like I see him.
Yeah, and you're like the fucking Oklahoma refs when it, Oklahoma umpires when it comes to Oregon and chicken.
They make incredible chicken in Portland. Like, I can't help that. I wish it were in Seattle. I wish Toki were in Seattle because I could go to it way more often if it were in Seattle.
Although, are you going to tell me that the river is better than Lake Union? What are you going to tell me next? Don't even get me started on those mountains they have in Oregon.
Obviously, Mount Hood is a pale imitation of Mount Rainier. Let's be clear about that point.
Thank you.
You got to try this chicken sandwich the next time you go to Portland. Like, it was incredible. Like, this is now my I've been there one time. It's now my go-to. Now,
wow.
It appears it's not on the dinner menu, as I said. So that is going to limit my options, I guess. I can only have it Friday through Sunday at, you know, breakfast/lunchtime. But I'm going to go out of my way to have this again. That's okay, what I'm
well,
saying.
The next time I'm in Portland, Friday through Sunday at breakfast/lunchtime, I'll check that out.
Which you were the very last time you went there. So remain calm.
Anyway, let's go Blazers.
Well, let's talk about the Blazers, who now are tied at 2-2 in their Hello. Series after a blowout win with me in attendance on Saturday.
Oh, wow. They just knew that the Portland's number one fan was in attendance.
Damian Lillard went.
You had a sign that you held up that said Portland chicken above your head.
I would definitely hold up that sign. Damian Lillard shot 1-for-10 from the field and was...
For the game?
Yeah.
He finished 1-for-10?
He sure did. TJ Leaf made more field goals than Damian Lillard, and the Blazers won the game. Largely because Norman Powell was so awesome.
It was
awesome.
A three, the one shot that he hit? Or the dunk on a steal?
It was a three. I mean, he had a lot of free throws.
Didn't he have a dunk on a steal?
Not on Saturday, I don't think.
Huh.
I think that might have been Thursday in game three.
Wow.
So Norman Powell was awesome. Jusuf Nurkić.
Norman Powell is like Nikola quietly Jokic. Awesome, always.
People do love them, so Norman Powell.
Okay, what do you mean people?
People love them some Norm Powell.
Okay, I mean, I love Norm Powell, but let's just be clear here.
There was a Norman Powell chant in the arena on Saturday.
Oh my God.
What a time to be alive.
Wow.
Which there was also 8,000 people there. They opened up the capacity dramatically for the two playoff games, which was great to see. That's by far the most people I've seen, you know, that have been in any game I've attended out of the four that I've attended since the pandemic started, and it felt much more normal, much more like a playoff atmosphere. It was cool.
You're going to tell me it's a better playoff atmosphere than the most recent playoff basketball game you've been to in Seattle?
No, it wasn't a better atmosphere than game two of the finals.
Game two of the finals?
No, I guess that was a less professional basketball. The last basketball game I attended was in, like, Noah Williams beating UW in the Apple Cup on March 1st, 2000. 20, so that wasn't super great as far as atmosphere went, I wouldn't say.
Oh, Lord. I love how I've changed the narrative today. You love Portland instead of me, like 2 weeks ago, was moving to Portland and cheering for Oregon State, I think.
That's correct. It certainly wasn't Oregon.
Look, our feelings for the state are complicated.
They sure are.
Can we just be clear about what happened in Game 3?
That the Austin Rivers made a ton of threes?
The Blazers did not play well. They did not shoot the ball well in Game 3. And Austin Rivers came down and hit two contested threes to end the game. The fact that the Blazers were even in the game in Game 3 was impressive, considering how they played. And I told this to you that very night, Blazers in 6. They were going to run off the next 3 in a row, and I still stand by it. They're a better team. This is the reality. Even hearing, like, I actually have a thought for you after this, but the talent-wise, the Blazers are a better team than this current Nuggets team is. Maybe
that's
Jokic
why I picked them
is,
in the series.
Maybe Jokic is better. I'm not saying this to you. I'm saying this in general. Maybe Jokic is a better player than anybody who's on the Blazers, and he is just terrifying sometimes. But, like, if the refs are not going out of their way to give fouls to Nurk, there was a foul that they called, I think this is Game 3, where he was on the ground, and they gave him a foul. It's just like, he did nothing. If they're not going out of their way to foul Nurk out of the game because they want Jokic, their little MVP, to go off, right? Adam Silver wants to hype the MVP. I get it. I get it, NBA. But, like, he's going to be done in the first round, your MVP. Look, you made a mistake. It's fine. You could have picked anybody else.
Mistake.
You could have picked any player. Look, Joel Embiid's going to be out of the first round. Dame Lillard's going
to
be out of the first round.
The third place voter is already out of the, didn't make the playoffs.
Who is that?
Steph Curry.
Oh.
He was second on my ballot. He didn't make the playoffs.
Yeah. So maybe you should rethink this whole ballot then. 1 and 3 are out of the playoffs already. It's kind of weird. But maybe we should redefine value. Anyway.
We did. We did it. We're here. In the Northeast.
Maybe we should vote for the MVP after the playoffs are over.
That's a terrible idea.
Anyway.
The problem is that, like, people bring this up, and the problem is that people's memory is about, like, 3.5 seconds, as far as I can tell.
The Blazers are a better team, top to bottom. The Blazers are a better team. They're deeper. If they're going to miss threes, like, there are shots that should have gone in Game 3 that didn't. They should have won that game.
They are the better team. They don't have home court advantage. We'll see how much of a factor that is, because, you know, if the Nuggets win Game 5, then suddenly the Blazers have to win 2 in a row, which they did in 2019. It's not something that can't be done, but it's a much
more
difficult
challenge.
Oh, they'll
win 2 in a row. And that's Game 5 and Game 6. Well, it's over. It is over.
Okay.
I'm telling you right now, top to bottom, this is if
they were a better team in when they lost 2 of the first 3 games, still, right?
The Game 2, they couldn't have won. Game 3, the it was just Austin Rivers had some lucky
Austin Rivers might hit some fucking threes again. Like, that's going to happen.
If they had the
that's
roster
why
randomness that they
have, exists.
If they had the roster that they had right now for the entire season, they would be the 3 seed and the Nuggets would be the 6 seed.
I don't know. I had the Nuggets would drop 3 spots because the Blazers were better.
They would have been so intimidated by the Blazers, they would have lost a few games.
That is some Feldenkrais math if I've ever heard it.
Oh, God.
All right, one last thing on the food segment. Returning to Seattle, returning back north to Seattle. Hmm. Climate Pledge Arena last week announced the Climate Collective for food at the arena.
Oh, my God.
With executive chef Molly Demers for Vandagement Company Delaware North. They said they're attempting to source 75% of their ingredients from within 300 miles of the arena, which there. Does put Portland well within
the chicken. Source all your chicken from Portland.
Sadly, neither Screen Door nor Toki are among the local initial restaurant partners, which are Ballard Pizza Company, Din Tai Fung, Elliot's Oyster House, Just Poke, Le Woody's, our friends, and Metropolitan Grill. So some similarities. Certainly you see some overlap with T-Mobile Park, which has at least Le Woody's and Din Tai Fung.
If I go to a basketball game and I see somebody just chomping down on some oysters, somebody's getting punched. Like, I'm sorry, but...
What? First off, we do not condone violence on the Fountain. Yet.
Really, there's been a lot of violence, actually, at these games lately.
Too kinda, much? Kinda way weird. Too much.
Has anybody written the story and be like, fans are back in their arena, but at what cost? Like, is that, exactly is, has that happened yet? It's time to start asking the question, should there be fans at arenas at all?
I don't think anyone has framed it quite that way.
There's
even the players involved.
Sometimes you can have nice food, and that food should not be consumed while watching hockey and basketball. Like the idea
well,
that you're going to
know that you're just eating at a fucking restaurant beforehand anyway.
What?
You're just eating at a fucking restaurant beforehand anyway. Do you not remember your rant last week on this podcast?
Yeah. I think I love the idea of Little Woody's. Can we take arena food and elevate arena food? Can we have the highest quality of arena food instead of being like it's not Din Tai Fung is not like clean food to eat sitting on your lap, right?
I mean that's what the chopsticks are for. I don't know if you're aware of this.
Okay.
I don't know how skilled you are with chopsticks.
Am I crazy for thinking this, that it's kind of weird to be eating poke while you're at a hockey game?
I don't know. I mean there's a lot of live raw
fish
octopus
that yeah, get yeah. thrown onto the
so I think it's I think it fits. I think this is a bad take.
You really think this is a bad take? I think it's kind of weird?
I mean, oysters in particular, maybe a bridge too far, but like I said, they've done them at Blazers games. I haven't tried them there. So it's nothing new.
I was noting this week that hockey is like an ostensibly a working class sport, right?
But it has the most expensive tickets?
Well, I feel like the entire culture is totally transformed in the U.S., right? Like basketball is the most working class American sport, right?
I guess in which sense? In terms of who plays the sport?
And even who is a fan of the sport.
It's the most youthful. I don't know if I would say it's the most working class.
What do you think is the most working class? Football?
I mean, football just has so broad appeal, but probably, I don't know.
Like, I feel like hockey and soccer, ironically, which theoretically should be probably the two most working class sports in the entire world, have become the two most bourgeois sports in the entire country.
Well, people realize there's a lot of money to be made in pro sports. So mm-hmm. that's a thing that happened. I don't know what to tell you.
Don't you think hockey is like a historically working class sport, though?
Sure.
And that people are going to be going and being like, I'll have the poke. There's nothing weird about this to you.
You're going to have all sorts of options. No one is forcing you to eat poke at the game. You're free to go to Little Woody's and Ballard Pizza Company and enjoy the elevated versions of those staples. And I'm sure there will be locations that will not be specifically tied to any local restaurant partner that will have nachos and hot dogs and the like.
There we go.
So enjoy those.
I'm on the tip of hyper acceptance. I don't know. Have we talked about this?
I don't think we have time yet. We're okay. Already over an hour.
All right, we'll talk about hyper acceptance later on.
You have no hot takes this week. I'm just going to note that the Mariners are now a game above 500. Do you want to know what their run differential is?
What's that?
Take a guess.
I have it in the notes. I know.
It's minus 42.
It's pretty much.
It's such Mariners baseball. I love it. Just screwing up that draft pick for next year.
All right, hyper acceptance for the Mariners.
Oh, I will never practice hyper acceptance with the Mariners, good sir.
Being 500. God, there's just no podcast where people talk about sports and hype. Like, I just sometimes do you ever read the Pelton quotes and are just like, this is the only podcast where this convergence of ideas is happening?
Yes. Are there times where I read this and don't think that? No. No, they're right. Let's talk about the Sounders, who had a 0-0 draw on Sunday against Austin FC with the apparent go-ahead goal by Freddy Montero in the 75th minute called back for offsides on Raul Ruidíaz after VAR review. And we have always, always hated VAR. It was kind of a desultory draw, I would say. Not a lot of opportunities for either side. So this was it felt more like the Sounders leaving 2 points on the table against the road-weary Austin FC than them staying unbeaten necessarily, although they remain first in the West heading into this period where they'll have the next 2 weeks off with the extended international window. But some bad news for the Sounders. On Friday, Brian Schmetzer told reporters that both Stefan Fry and Nico Lodero would be sidelined longer than expected. Fry experienced blood clots in his left knee, which had sidelined him and will likely need to take blood thinners and would be unable to play as long as he's on those because of the risk if he's cut. So, you know, obviously this is a very serious thing. And number one, we hope Stephen Fry is okay with that. And number two, hope that he is able to get back on the field as quickly as possible. Meanwhile, Lodeiro underwent arthroscopic surgery to address ongoing inflammation in his knee. No timetable for the return for either of them, but Schmetzer did say, we expect both players to be back for part of the regular season.
The regular season has been noted.
Very long.
It's a very long
time.
Not
quite as long this year since they started so late.
Being back for part of the regular season could mean a lot of things.
It could. I mean, the good news is the Sounders have... They have conceded one goal in two games with Stephen Cleveland in goal, and they've played basically the entire season without Nico Lodeiro, who played off the bench in one game, and the offense has generally been pretty good without him despite that.
That was my question for you, is do we start being, in as much as we actually care about this, do we start being concerned about the offense at this point? You know, the 1-1 draw that they had against Atlanta, they scored the goal, but there weren't a lot of opportunities outside of that goal. And then a 0-0 draw with Austin, both of these games happening at home. The offense is not as dynamite as it might have looked early in the season.
I mean, I think the game against Atlanta was easier to explain in terms of they scored a goal early and then kind of shut things down and played defensive. Like, that was a more reasonable explanation for that. And then they had only, you know, 4 minutes in stoppage time to try to get an extra goal after Atlanta did manage to tie that one.
I don't think a team that is the best team in the MLS scores a goal and then shuts it down.
It was more acceptable as an explanation.
I can buy it as an excuse, but I'm sorry. That's not what a good team is. That's a negative 43 run differential and being 500 type of excuse.
Oh, no.
Like,
I mean, it's also 2 weeks, and they've played a lot of other games. So I'm not ready to, like, the DEFCON has moved down a notch, I guess, from wherever we were previously.
They were 5-0-1 in those other matches.
But we're not at DEFCON 1 or even DEFCON 2 at this point. Maybe we're at 3.
I don't know which DEFCON you want to be at.
You want to be at the highest DEFCON.
In a good way?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What does DEFCON stand for? Definitive?
No, it's defense. Oh. I can't remember what the con part of it is off the top of my head.
Wow.
I know. I'm losing my touch. I haven't watched
at DEFCON 3.
I haven't read the War Games Wikipedia in entirely too long. Let's talk about the Ola Rain while you look this up, who suffered a 1-0 loss on Sunday to the Washington Spirit.
It looks like it's one of the world's largest and most notable hacker conventions held annually in Las Vegas, Nevada.
No, different one. Rose Lavelle got the start Sunday in her Rain debut after just 3 practices with the team and played 64 minutes. Lavelle set up Ziara King for an apparent goal that was also called back for offside. The lone goal in this match came from a Spirit corner that was deflected into the net and credited as an own goal to Megan Rapinoe. Later in the match, Rain keeper Karen Bardsley left with a possible leg injury, so that's a concern looking ahead. OL keeper Sarah Bouadi is due to arrive on loan later this month, but some period of time where the Rain may be down their first choice in goal. This week, they'll travel across the country to face Gotham FC, which comes in with an identical 1-1-1 record thus far. Those two teams tied for 5th in the NWSL standings. Big news for the Seattle Storm this week, and it was not their 82-72 win on Friday against the Minnesota Lynx that I attended. 2 days after that, we got a surprise when Dan Hughes...
It stands for South Korean rapper and comedian.
No, come on.
It stands for defense readiness condition.
Okay, condition. Dan Hughes on Sunday announced his retirement and effective immediately. And I mean, this is surprising, happening mid-season with a team that is playing very well at 5-1. In hindsight, you sort of could see some of the clues. So last week, we mentioned he was away from the team for his son's graduation from the Air Force Academy. And when he came back, he talked a lot about the importance of family, mentioned this repeatedly in his media availabilities. And it became clear eventually, I had a chance to interview him on Sunday for ESPN. We'll play that entire interview at the end of the pod this week. But you know, talked about spending more time with them and just kind of the grind of the season taking a toll on him after he had been away from the team in 2020 when he wasn't cleared medically to travel to the WNBA's campus site at IMG Academy in Bradenton, Florida. And so despite, you know, the team being in position to again contend for another title, decided the time was right to walk away, especially because, you know, one thing he mentioned to me was leaving it in good shape for the next person who's going to be Noel Quinn taking over him for him as head coach. And that's where the Storm are right now.
Absolutely. So what you're telling me is that you're going to air this interview with championship head coach Dan Hughes after me talking about how I've been practicing hyper acceptance.
Correct.
I'm going to hyper accept that that's the case. And how does the decision after Kloppy goes out and wins a championship in the bubble season?
Yeah, so Gary Kloppenberg was the head coach last year in 2020. He's been the interim head coach in 2017 after Jenny Busek was fired before they hired Dan Hughes. Also spent 2 years as the head coach of the Tulsa Shock. So he's got a lot of experience.
You would assume that when you told me that Dan Hughes had retired, I said Kloppy's the coach.
Right.
Right.
And instead they decided to go with Noel Quinn because, you know, she's sort of the long-term coaching prospect, someone that, you know, Dan Hughes had been mentoring over these last few years. He's got an extensive coaching tree of former assistant coaches throughout the league that's now grows by one, including, remarkably, Noel Quinn becomes the third former WNBA player who's an active head coach in the league, along with Vicky Johnson in Dallas and Sandy Brondello in Phoenix. And both of them, their first jobs were in San Antonio, hired by Dan Hughes after working as an assistant coach to him. So, you know, that's an interesting symmetry in that standpoint. So I think this was always kind of the long-term play. And also, you know, Klopp, one of the things that Hughes has mentioned is he basically has no ego. He's, you know, he's just in this for the success of the team at this point. So I think he kind of saw, you know, the bigger picture here, I assume, even though we haven't had the chance to speak to him about this yet.
It's an interesting question, though, but you have to feel like it was a surprise decision to turn the team over to Noel Quinn at this point.
So the other thing that kind of presaged this is last week, that game against Connecticut happens on Tuesday where Dan Hughes missed for his son's graduation. And we all kind of assumed Kloppenberg would be the head coach. In fact, you know, that's what had been mentioned to us and we'd kind of gone with. And then Noel Quinn ended up doing the media availability pregame. There was a kind of a funny moment where I asked her what the starting lineup was going to be. And she was like, am I allowed to say that? Because, you know, she didn't know. Now she gets to decide whether she's allowed to say that, which
Dan Hughes, respond?
I did not. The PR representative mentioned
what did they say?
Dan Hughes does typically say what the starting lineup is going to be, although some coaches like Terry Stotts don't like to disclose that pregame.
What's the difference, Terry? Come on!
I 100% believe this.
God, so stupid.
As much as I like Terry Stotts,
you could put in players. You could play a player for 1 minute and then pull them out. Literally, who's starting does not matter.
Super performative, in my opinion.
God.
But anyway,
all right, that's it. We're done with Portland.
So she did that, and then, you know, we watched the end of that game here with Luca, and you saw the huddles. Noel Quinn was in there drawing up the plays. She was the person who was standing up on the sidelines and really acting as the head coach, even though, you know, Hughes said afterwards that basically he had, like, delegated certain duties to Klopp and certain duties to Noel Quinn. But this was kind of her moment, and that's one of the things Hughes said again in this interview you listened to, is that him seeing her take that leadership role in this game against Connecticut was part of what helped convince him that this time was right for him to step away and turn over the team to her. And, you know, a very powerful, I think, introductory press conference that Noel Quinn had with the media earlier today on Monday, talking about, number one, you know, her responsibility is a black female head coach and a former player, and, you know, kind of the people seeing that and the representation that signifies, the first black coach in Storm history in this 22nd season for the Storm. And then also just talking about, you know, the being honored to take over this position at this point in a franchise that's the defending champions and with a bunch of players that she played with, because, you know, she was a part of the 2018 championship team before retiring and joining the coaching staff. So, you know, she's played with Sue Bird, Brianna Stewart, you know, several of the core players on this team. So it is actually younger than Sue Bird. It's kind of an amusing note.
Wow.
So
the And this seems to sort of be what the Storm season is, right? They could have sat back and basically brought the same team back. And they chose not to. They were pretty aggressive this offseason and shaking things up.
They didn't necessarily face that choice because, you know, players were free agents and they had a say in that as well. But I think
the team was, for a defending champion, this team was shaken up more than almost any defending champion you ever see.
I mean, and you go back to the 2005 team, 2004 team that won the championship, you had even more dramatic changes in free agency. But I think what it is of a piece of is we saw that Talisa Rhea was promoted to GM this year, taking over those duties from Alicia Valvanis, who remains the president and CEO. We've seen that Crystal Langhorne retired and joined the front office in her role as doing community outreach. And this is something the Storm have really taken investment in, is developing former players, putting them in position to succeed, and, you know, promoting from within. And I think this is very much of a piece of that, that, you know, they've seen Noelle Quinn as a future head coach even before she necessarily saw that in herself, and have worked to get her in position to be ready for this.
All right.
So she's going to be, she's had one day of practice. And then Tuesday, they'll take on the Indiana Fever in a game that's going to be nationally televised on ESPN2 Tuesday night. And then a home back-to-back, I should say, against the Dallas Wings on Friday and Sunday. So a busy week coming up for Noelle Quinn. The Storm Friday, you know, very oddly, in Dan Hughes' last game, was maybe the best performance they've had. You know, as good as anything, even in last year's championship season,
really?
Where they were up 20 plus most of this game against a Minnesota team that was my pick to win the championship.
Wow.
You know, a little bit shorthanded in this game. And then they scored 5 points in the entire fourth quarter with their subs in the game. So that's why the final margin wasn't as lopsided as kind of the game was. But they're clicking on all cylinders right now. They seem to have settled on a starting lineup with Mercedes Russell at center. They'll get Katie Lou Samuelson back this week after she helped USA Basketball's 3x3 team clinch a spot in the Olympics.
Oh, huge.
Her and Kelsey Plum. Kelsey Plum was very emotional after that one. It's the post-game interview.
What is the radius of where... Did we talk about this before, where you're like not a big enough star that you're going to be definitely playing for the WNBA team, but you're... still good enough that you're going to play for the 3-on-3 team?
For the national team, 5-on-5. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is why it works out well for the U.S., because they're able to send players that are like starting quality players in the WNBA to this competition.
Kelsey Plum, let's say the Olympics happen as planned. Kelsey Plum is going to be on that team, on the 3-on-3 team, on the 5-on-5 team?
On the 3-on-3 team, yeah.
Wow.
It looks like they'll... I mean,
every child just dreams growing up of winning the... gold medal for the 3-on-3 basketball championship. This is not a number that you play. You play 2-on-2 or you play 5-on-5. How did they settle on 3-on-3?
What do you mean? I mean, like the three big three is a 3-on-3.
I guess so.
I think that's it's a growing thing for sure. So I watched the game. It was technically the semifinal, but they didn't play a final because the winners of the two semifinals.
Is it full court?
No, it's half court.
Half court, and you take it back?
Yes. So the winners of the two semifinals clinched Olympic berths, and then France beat Japan in the third place game to clinch the third and final. Japan beat France, I should say. So Japan got in as hosts. They had to still win their way in. It's a pretty fast-paced game. It's pretty fun, I would say. And the games are only 10 minutes. They're either 10 minutes or the first team to 21 by ones and twos. So it moves pretty quickly.
It's especially good if you're like 45 years old and out of shape.
No, you gotta be. That's a misnomer about half court basketball. You actually have to be in better shape a lot of times to play half court basketball because there's so many stoppages in 5-on-5, whereas 3-on-3 is more free flowing. So,
if somebody came to me right now as a 36-year-old and was like, you could play half court 3-on-3 or you could play full court.
When's the last time you played either of those in a real competitive situation that did not involve small children?
Well, when you put that caveat on it.
We didn't do a coach's corner this week.
There were no games. Took the week off for Memorial Day.
Well, we did practice earlier today with Luca.
Oh, God. You've been waiting to gloat about your power hitting all day.
You were so amazed by my power hitting.
I mean, you hit like...
expected.
What was I expecting? God, you're like fucking John Kruk out there.
I switch hit even.
Oh,
my left hand hitting was not very strong this week.
No, I mean, you hit that ball. I don't know.
Just lofting them over Mrs. Fantasy Genius in the outfield.
No, I was actually kind of shocked at your power rating for baseball. I didn't realize you were what you were doing over there. It's apparently it's playing baseball.
I'm just sneaking off and playing baseball with people all the time.
3-on-3. You know, it's really growing. It's a fast-paced game of baseball. It's really fast-paced. You hit the ball, and then somebody chases it down for like 10 minutes.
Well, that actually would be more fun than baseball, maybe.
It's been a while. I think the last time that I played competitive basketball was probably with you at the SPU gym that time we played.
Oh, you came. Yeah, that's right. You came one time to Staff Hoops with your friend, and then we went out for sandwiches at the place in Fremont afterwards.
Yeah, that was probably the last time that I played any sort of like mildly competitive basketball.
Yeah, I'm retired now. Sadly, it's
you're retired.
I'm retired.
Wow, didn't even warn an emergency pod. You retiring from basketball?
You know, it was kind of a gradual thing.
If somebody hit me up tomorrow and I was like, "Do you want to play basketball?" I'd be there.
And I mean, it's not because of performance. It is concerns about my Achilles soreness.
You would not play?
Not in a 5-on-5 setting, no.
You would coach. Would you play in a 3-on-3 setting, half court?
If there are small children involved. We've seen that I did that. But even when I did that, my Achilles hurt afterwards.
Wow.
So that was what convinced me.
How did this get saved for the very end of the podcast?
I don't know. This is the
ESPN's
big news.
Kevin Pelton is retired from basketball.
We are still putting this before the interview. With champion head coach Daniels.
You retiring to me is bigger news.
Oh no.
Oh my god.
This podcast is really something.
No, it's just like Simmons sometimes, or he'll be like Dame Judi Dench, but first Jacko. Right? Yes. He's like, we've got Barack Obama, but we've got to talk to Joe House first for 25 minutes about Wizards basketball.
A real power broker in DC.
It's a two-part podcast with Ryan Russillo. And then we talk to Buzz Aldrin's ghost. Like,
oh, boy. Well, on that note.
We're not even going to talk about all rain. We're skipping them.
We did them.
You typed in notes.
We did them.
Did we?
You really don't pay any attention to what I'm saying.
Buzz Aldrin, still alive.
Way to kill Buzz Aldrin.
Apologies to Buzz Aldrin.
Buzz Aldrin living in the Northwest or the Northeast, you never know. Could be either. They're all the same to Tristan.
Oh my god, you think I thought you were saying that he actually lives in the Northwest, and I was like, wow, I didn't know that, but Buzz Aldrin didn't know he's alive.
Don't know where he lives. I'm just
oh
saying.
My god.
Well,
thanks for listening.
So first off, curious kind of when you started thinking about this and when you came to a final decision.
Well, you know, honestly, I've thought about it even before the season. From the standpoint of I, it's always been important to me to kind of leave, you know, knowing this is near the end of my career, leaving it in a better position than I found it. That's just one of the staples of my career. The other is mentoring people, you know, and doing those things, especially the young, you know, the former players of mine that like that. So it's been something I've thought about for a long time, just wanting to make sure that, you know, when the time was right, that there was the ability to kind of hand it off, so to speak. And you know what? And you never know when the right time is. That's, you know, I have this conversation with a lot of us older coaches. And to be honest with you, the time seems to be right. The way that the team has kind of evolved, the reality, I think, of how I've kind of leaned on Noe and kind of leaned on Klopp and how well they work together. It just you know, when I was talking with it, with the ownership, but it just seemed like the right moment, Kevin.
And when did you kind of bring everyone else into that loop?
Took the last couple of days and, you know, and aside from my family, I brought people into it today.
Obviously this had to kind of been a thought when you were away from the team last week and watching Noe in particular step into that role. And was that kind of a confirmation she's ready?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I'm a very faith-based guy, and that, you know, that picture in my head, that, you know, I remember calling her after the game and just saying, I'm so proud of you, you know, watching your presence and what you're doing. And, yeah, that it's just funny how sometimes things kind of fall into place for a reason. And I constantly preach about watching the journey you're on, whether it's a team or whether it's an individual, because sometimes that journey will teach you and will have moments that you actually need to recognize. And I thought that was probably one right there.
When you reflect back on the 3+ seasons in Seattle, what role does that play in this career that you've had?
Well, simply blessed, because I thought I'd retired once before. Mm-hmm. But to come here, to make some of the relationships that I have made with players, great players, I might add, to make a relationship with a city, I just feel blessed. I feel a little blessed. I would have been happy where I was in San Antonio, but I can't imagine what I would have missed without this opportunity here. And, you know, being able to coach till 66, as a head WNBA coach, you know, that there's something fulfilling about that, you know, for a guy who struggled to get a head job way back at the beginning. There's something kind of good about that. And I'm not done coaching. It might be my grandkids. Who knows? That's what I told the team. I don't know, you know, but I'm not going to be a WNBA coach. You know, that's not one of the things. But I'm going to look and see if I can stay attached to basketball and coaching in some form. We'll see. If not, it'll be the grandkids.
Well, and you've certainly got no shortage of, you know, as you've mentioned, people around the league, former assistants coaching teams that, you know, I'm sure would love your advice or your help.
Oh, I'll stay busy, and that will be a joy, you know, and having the WNBA league pass and the NBA league pass are like number one and number two on my to-do list as far as every year. So there you go.
Going back to your Storm career, I mean, one of the things I'm going to take with me is the smile on your face. I mean, I wasn't there, but seeing the photos and videos from the night of the championship in 2018, I mean, was that, you know, kind of something that was missing in your career, having that championship moment that was fulfilled a little bit?
Yeah. You know, could I have appreciated the career I had without it? Yes, I could have, but would have something been empty or just a little bit hollow? Yes, that gave me a moment that not everybody gets to experience, you know, and that smile and that embrace of my wife, you know, it's on my computer right now. I mean, that is a moment that, first of all, I wasn't sure I'd have that, you know, after my career had stopped. So to have it, that one, you recognize something that will identify with me for the rest of my life.
For sure. You sort of talked about this a bit, but when did you know that Noe had the potential to become a head coach in this league?
Quite honestly, I thought she was a very smart player, but it was that first year, the dialogue that we would have on the bench, you know, because my mind offensively is not the most technical. I don't think in terms, and I should, of screening and certain things like that. My mind thinks about, you know, where we can attack, how to get space for a player. And what started to happen was I would talk with her, and then she came up with our actions or things, and she would put them in and she would talk me through them. And that dialogue was just special. I mean, and it still was, you know, when we're playing in, I think it was, we're down four at Dallas, and I'm like saying, well, man, we need to do something from our 21 series here, you know, they're coming like that. Well, she takes what I say, I go, cause we want to play full court. We want to do that. She takes it and could put it into communication to the players. Honestly, better than me. And those are the things that you just register, you know, and especially having had so many former players, Sandy Brondello, you know, kind of doing that, Vicky Johnson kind of doing that, and now Noe kind of doing it. You can just kind of see when the moment is correct.
Mm-hmm. What kind of value do you think there is to the fact that she has coached her own team at the high school level, in addition to all the experience at the
huge, game? Huge, Kevin, huge. I'll give you an example. Susie McConnell Cirio was one of my players in Cleveland, and she was a high school coach back there. Well, she turned around and went to Minnesota, got hired by Minnesota, was coach of the year in one of the early years, and she went back to college. But it's huge, because I saw the same thing in Susie that I'm seeing in Noe and Vanessa Nygaard's at Vegas. And she had worked with me in Santa. Same thing. That there is no replacing when you're in that seat to make the final call. I don't care if it's I was a high school. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if it's a JV Division III game. When you're in that seat and it kind of rests on you, that there's something about having some experience with that decision that is irreplaceable. So I think it matters a lot, to be honest with you.
And then how useful is it to have a coaching staff? Klopp, obviously, his experience in the league and then with the Storm specifically, and then other people ready to kind of slide up a role as well because of their experience the last couple of years.
Well, when I talked to the team today and I talked to Klopp, that's one of the times I got emotional, was because the partnership he and I had was pretty seamless. You know, if I had to step away from the team to have cancer surgery, he just took it on, you know, and then I could come back in. And he truly, and I see him work with Noe, and I see the same chemistry that is just so healthy. And he is such a selfless, excellent coach that he just wants to coach basketball. You know, And I'd like to think that's pretty rare in coaching, where he understands his worth by kind of what he's doing on the court, you know, in regard to it. And I think they'll make a great pair, and pretty much had set those lanes up from the start of the year, you know, not knowing exactly, you know, these were all things that were important in my head to give Klopp the presence to really, you know, go to an area that he loves and is very good at, and to do the same thing with Noe, you know, and then me kind of fill in around that as best I could. But what it's done is just set up a thing that they'll keep right on going in those regards. And I'm sure they'll grow, but the truth is they were doing so much. It's not going to be tremendously different for them.
What were the reactions like from players today?
Well, it was really nice when I told them, you know, they're looking back at me, and what I'm seeing coming back made me feel good. When I thanked my wife, who was in the back of the room, I mean, they gave her a round of applause, which meant the world to me. And then just to follow up, to be honest with you, you know, it just reinforces it that you're just blessed to be around people that are that good and that have the ability to kind of be in your life in a positive way too. You know, they're not just great basketball players. They're players that also are people that I admire. And that one of the conversations with one of the players that I had, that's exactly what I said. You know, as good as you are, I mean, as a person, I absolutely love being in your presence. And that's a special thing when you're talking about that level of talent.
Yeah. I'm sure you'll be back, but anything in particular about Seattle you're going to miss?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. the early morning walks, you know, the cool weather, my Starbucks. And you know, I would walk and my wife would walk with me all the way to the practice facility from the hotel that I stayed in here. It's two mile walk. I'm going to miss it. And then when I lived here, the walks in the morning in Olympic Park and all that, looking at the boats and things, you know, going to miss those a lot. Going to miss those a lot, to be honest with you. But I'll be back. As I told the team, I'm going to be enjoying every game with them. But physically, I'm also going to support.
That's awesome. All right, I think that's all I had.
Well, thank you, Kevin. Appreciate you.
Yeah, likewise.